Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friends Show. I hope all of you had a wonderful long weekend. I am your host, Nicholas Larimer, back today with Sarah Gaughan. Sarah, how are you doing?
Well, thank you, Nick. Thanks.
Very good to have you back with us. And of course, joining us from Cape Town, Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Nice to be with you both again.
Very good, very good. Right, let's get into the news of the day. And I think one of the most interesting stories going on at the moment is the ongoing, I guess, sort of ideology, identity, personality crisis going on within the ANC and its alliance partners. So recently we've seen groups like some factions of the of COSATU attacking the ANC and the Government of National Unity. We've also seen some members of the South African Communist Party. In fact, it seems like the majority of the South African Communist Party attacking the Government of National Unity. Various comments like the SACP's KwaZulu-Natal secretary saying that the ANC will never pursue the National Democratic Revolution lying in one bed with the DA. And there's been accusations from the South African Communist Party that the ANC has sold out the revolution by going into government with the DA, that it is selling out the black working class. Further, there have been very explicitly racial demands from the MK Party and from the EFF, and indeed from some of these affiliates of the ANC, parts of the ANC, to form what they call as a sort of what they refer to as a black government of national unity, where, you know, the sort of progressive black forces all unite together to form one political organization. Interestingly, however, David Masondo, who is the Deputy Secretary General of the South African Communist Party and also is a deputy minister, has pushed back against this idea during a lecture and has supported the government of national unity. Speaking at the University of South Africa, he expressed his support for the GNU and spoke out against a call often made in the student politics of these radical universities for quote-unquote black political parties to unite. He said, quote, "As we support the government of national unity and oppose the so-called government of black unity through black political parties, regardless of what they stand for, Simiso would have said to us, we should be building the working class unity, unifying COSATU, SAFTU, Solidarity, and FEDUSA as a necessary step towards uniting the entire working class and building an inclusive economy based on working class solidarity." At the beginning of the South African Students Organization, which was established by Steve Biko, analyzed society in racial terms and called for black unity, echoing those narrow nationalists who are now calling for a government of black unity through black parties, regardless of what they stand for. Black parties unite? For what? What do they stand for? What is the call for black unity, regardless of what the party stands for? Is it progressive? He then went on to call for student movements to adopt what he called a class approach. Now, I have complicated feelings on this. In one sense, I think being a communist, I suspect his class-based analysis of South African society would come to very different conclusions than what I would come to. That being said, it is something quite refreshing to see the communists pushing once again, rather separating themselves, or at least some parts of the communists, separating themselves from a racialized narrative and returning to a class narrative, because unlike race, which is not a very useful concept for analyzing society, class is a much more useful concept, even if I think the communists would probably reach the wrong conclusion. Michael, let me start with you. What do you make here of David Masondo's analysis here? And I think this is definitely a move in the right direction for the South African Communist Party.
Yes, I definitely think so. I do agree with you that you and I would probably not necessarily agree with David Masondo on quite how we saw a shift from a racial obsession to looking at class instead. But certainly from our point of view, what we see here, what the potential here would be that, now we're going to look at how people actually live. Are they well off? Are they poor? What is it that is standing in the way of their being active participants in the economy, having agency in their own lives and so on. And there were obviously all sorts of things that we would associate with that. The expansion of property rights as being a primary thing, whatever empowerment or whatever steps of the taxpayers' money to help people, direct it at people who really need it and so on, instead of what people judging the problem by thinking that you can judge it by what people look like. I think it's very, positive in that sense. I'm a little bit reminded of, I was just kind of thinking back to 1923, for instance. You know, I think the left in this country has always seemed to battle with this thing of separating itself from whichever race nationalism of the time is the convenient one or is the approved one. So the 1923, it was very much a kind of white working class thing. So and then it became, you know, associated with race, Black power and all the rest within the left was really attached to that. So hopefully what we're seeing is perhaps something of a divorce from all of that. And I think communists can be quite interesting, actually. I mean, they do have something of a tradition of kind of thinking a little more seriously minded, in a more seriously minded way than populists, certainly. I think you know, people like Jack Simon and his wife Ray Alexander, you know, two feisty old souls, very interesting people in their own right. I don't really share much ideologically with them at all, but they were nevertheless interesting people who you felt were really engaged in, you know, what is happening in the society and what needs to be done. And this is partly the sense one gets from Masonde. You know, he's not interested, it seems, in the kind of populist cry, let black parties unite. And he's questioning it quite vividly, actually, to say, you know, what does this actually mean? This is very much a kind of liberal question, really. I mean, all strength to that kind of direction of march. But let's just see how it pans out.
So, Sara, I think politically speaking, one of the big questions about the government of national unity is what does it do to the ANC? Clearly, the ANC is an organization in crisis, and I think the most recent election results make that abundantly clear. The question to me has always been, you know, does the ANC actually embrace a different path forward? Or does it just sort of continue in this incoherent mass rolling down a hill and inevitably fragments into 1,400 different pieces that, you know, are all variations of the EFF and MK to different degrees, with sort of like occasional ethnic nationalism thrown in? Do you think that these sort of internal, that these public spats between the ANC's alliance members suggest that the ANC might in fact be slightly changing direction here? What do you think?
I think, you know, I think it's, what do they say about democracy? It's too soon to tell whether it's been a success. I think what's important here is, A, you've got, Masondo's a young man, so he's really in the next generation of ANC leaders. I agree with Michael, very much more, there is a Communist Party tradition of sometimes saying things as they are, not as necessary as one would like them to be. How they deal with them is another thing altogether. And you've also got, I think I saw a report today that Ronald Lamola, the foreign minister, wants to make overtures to improve the relationships of the rest. And he would probably also be considered in that cohort of young leaders. So irrespective of their, excuse me, of their sort of left-wing bent, you really see, I think, a new generation of leaders who through experience are coming perhaps to some conclusions that their dyed-in-the-wool old cadres probably aren't capable of doing anymore. They've just been around for too long. Things, you know, don't change easily. So I think that's quite an interesting thing. I think the other thing we can sort of make a little hay with is the fact that whether we're coming quite from the same place, we can hook on to Masondo from the basis of the IRR's position that you deal with things that need to change in the society and improve for people by concentrating on where the disadvantage is, what it is, not what color is the skin of the people who are experiencing the disadvantage? In other words, our EED program idea versus BEE. So I think there's something one can sort of create from that. Then there's also the sort of my tongue-in-cheek impression. Remember, David Musondo is a deputy minister of finance, and good communist that he may be, he also knows that, you know, all black unity and no mixing is probably not very good for the economy. So there's probably a bit of realpolitik in that as well.
So this kind of the South African Communist Party has been sort of married to this idea that race and class are super inexplicably linked in South African discourse. And going back, I think, to their colonialism of a special type document that was created, I think, in 1962. And, you know, during apartheid, that was a much more reasonable analysis of South African society to have. But 30 years after we've entered the democratic era, and also, you know, it's been even longer than 30 years, actually, since many of the racial laws were stripped out or significantly weakened. The question of, you know, racist centrality in determining disadvantage is, I think, a very different one. And we've seen so often that things like BEE have been used as a sort of smokescreen to essentially enrich people who have already made it at the expense of South African society at large. Michael, what do you make of all this?
Mm.
As a final thought.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I mean, isn't it telling that that in his lineup of working class unity, the organizations that he sees as being the desirable basis for achieving this working class unity, he includes solidarity. Now, I think, you know, just a year ago, that probably would have been absolutely unthinkable for somebody like him to dare say something like that. So it is a quite an interesting indication of where our politics has suddenly got to, that we've almost been able to step beyond the very fixed positions that everybody was holding. You have, you know, Musondo warning here against, where was the phrase I saw in this piece? He talks about this class approach being, quote, threatened today by creeping ethno-nationalism. That's a very interesting a phrase to use, and I'm sure, you know, part of what he's thinking about is MK and KZN based developing around the identity of Zuma and the identity of people living there as potentially a problem. I'm not sure, but it is a significant thing, and I think you know, quite healthy that this is all beginning to break up. They're going to be places where people can exert a little bit of pressure, open things up a little bit. We can start to talk about things that might have been unthinkable to talk about. And just very ordinary things. I mean, I often think of the fact that the SASSA grants are entirely non-racial. And that's the one thing that kind of works every month. You know, people are given this lifeline. And if, as we've often said, if you simply apply that very principle to everything else, you've stripped race right out of the legislative program and regulations and so on, and you can get on with dealing with real problems where they exist without having to generate this false narrative about, you know, proxies and so on. Take the sting out of it. It's a very divisive thing also. Sorry.
The welfare aspects of the, you know, welfare system, I mean, there's many things to criticize about South Africa's welfare system, but it has been in many ways one of the biggest successes of government since 1994. Mm. And as you say, it's exactly non-racial. In fact, I had an interesting example a couple of years ago when I was looking at RDP house settlements across the country. And this was in the middle of the Transkei, and there was an RDP house settlement where I think everyone was black except one resident, who was an old white guy who had, I don't know how he had ended up there in that part of the Transkei, but yeah, he had also qualified for an RDP house there. And actually, the whole community, including this guy, because I think he knew someone at a local lab, had banded together to protest the quality of the housing because it had been so badly built, because there was a sort of corruption thing going on there with the construction of those houses. And you kind of, you get the sense there of how, you know, we've got this sort of racial antagonist slather sloshed over the top of so much of South African society when really our real struggle is about defeating poverty. It does seem at the very least, like South Africa's government is now far more focused on economic growth. Whether we're actually going to implement the ideas that will get us to economic growth is a different question, one that has not been answered yet. But the focus towards growth rather than, you know, sort of endless redistribution, antagonism, justice seeking, that kind of stuff, is, I think, a very welcome one in our politics. Okay, yeah. Let's move on to our next story. And this is sort of two parts to what is quite horrifying, but I think of no surprise to South Africans. Since 2018, the police say they have been unable to solve 80,000 murders. There have been 80,000 unsolved murder cases since 2018. About two-thirds of all murder cases reported to the police between 2018 and now have gone unsolved. It's not just murder that there is a significant number of unsolved crimes. There's about 40,000 attempted murders, 141,000 assaults with intent to cause grievous bodily harm, 256,000 thefts, 61,000 rapes, 5,500 sexual assaults, and 9,000 kidnappings have all been unsolved. Also, according to the National Police Commissioner, between 2016 and 2023, the South African Police Service has lost 8,400 detectives who have left the force for various reasons, retired, passed away, gone on to seek better opportunities, et cetera, which means, of course, fewer people to solve some of these extremely problematic crimes. Also, kind of buttressing this point as to why our police are, you know, failing so spectacularly, the number of police members active in the country has dropped in 2011 from 193,000 to 183,000. And this has about 13,000 officers have gone missing. And many of the reasons for this are lack of budget to train new people, many experienced officers retiring, many people leaving the force due to poor working conditions, low morale, bad pay, political favoritism, that kind of thing. So clearly the police force is in a huge amount of crisis. Now you may ask yourself, well, sure, crime is bad in South Africa, but why is it not worse? Well, part of the reason for that is probably the fact that since 2001, the number of private security officers in the country has grown from 50,000 to 675,000 today, which means that there are many, many times more, something like four times more private security officers than police officers in the country today. But that's not entirely the solution to everything. So, Michael, what do you make of this? I mean, you know, we were discussing before the show the importance of protecting life, liberty, and property and all that kind of stuff is sort of that's the most basic function of a state. And unfortunately, our state is not seeming to be achieving it.
Indeed. So there's, you know, quite a clear tie in here with the previous story, as there are so many of the headline making events in South Africa. So if you look at this shocking number of cases which have now just not been solved, being passed over, you can pretty much assume that a very, very high percentage of those would be in poor communities. And these are communities that are being very, very poorly served by the kind of policing and the kind of policy making that had been increasingly focused on race and on transformation objectives and all these ancillary things instead of focusing on the actual problem at hand. And chickens have come home to roost in this way. I'm not saying that's the only reason, but it's a key reason, I think, in why so much of our policy has drifted off into the wrong direction, because we've been distracted by unnecessary things, which in fact would be better served by simply focusing on the problem at hand. I think that's one key element to make there, key point to make there. I mean, these figures are really quite staggering. So between 2011 and today, cops have dropped from 193,000 to 180,000. But in a slightly longer period, 2001 to 2024, private security from 50,000 to 675,000. I mean, that is really quite a staggering thing, and a reflection of, in a way, a fortunate thing, I suppose, the society having to find its own solutions in the absence of an effective, independent, accountable police service. That's really what it comes down to. And I think lots of those cops have left because they also can't stomach it. And for all, also for all the reasons that we've been speaking about, and for whatever reason it is, the fact that in a society like ours, a dwindling police force, where you have unsolved crimes, and never mind the new ones that are being committed. Now, I can't remember our figures for murder rate and serious crime. Rape is just absolutely shocking. Women in the society can't walk out of the door without feeling vulnerable, and that's just completely unacceptable. People who can have turned to private security. The private sector has had to protect itself. Companies. You often find staff who are working late, they have all sorts of special arrangements to get them safely home. They can't rely on their own means. They can't rely on public transport because it's just too dangerous. So it is a very natural and, in a sense, very welcome response from the private sector. But nevertheless, the problem is that it doesn't itself, but it risks obscuring what we really need to focus on, which is building that police force as an independent, accountable, effective institution of the state to protect life and property, to be there for us and for everybody, and to do so effectively. So one just hopes that, you know, the state departments aren't sitting around thinking, well, at least the private sector is there to step in and solve things for us, because it's not going to happen. And you, Nicholas, had some thoughts on that. In case you forget, I'm reminding you now just to share those thoughts, but on why, you know, there's a certain limited capacity in the private security sector, which the cops should have, but don't. So, yeah, it is a complex problem.
The point I was making there was, in our pre-show discussion, was that the private security, you know, sometimes they will try and push a case through the court systems and gather evidence and that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, it's not their job. They're not empowered by the law to do that. The society is never going to empower them to do that, regardless of, you know, I know there's some people who think that that would be the solution, but it's not, you know, I don't think it's politically even vaguely possible. So you have essentially the private security sector protecting life and property, but they're not actually making the justice system work. They're not following cases right through to the end. Sometimes they will, but it's really not their expertise. And you're not really going to get a proper handle on crime until the entire system works. Everything from investigations of crimes with proper detectives, to properly gathering the evidence, to properly putting it through the police, the court system, to finally delivering a just outcome on the other end. Sara, you know, for many years, South Africa is unfortunately, in terms of murders per 100,000 people, we have been in the top 10. Since 2021, though, things have gotten a lot worse, and we are now kind of maybe in the top 5 in the world, number 4 in terms of the number of murders in this country, according to some lists, number 3 according to others. We're at a murder rate which is somewhere around what Haiti's is. Now, just to remind people, in the last couple of years, Haiti's government has completely collapsed. So our society is unfortunately extremely violent. And, you know, the police need urgent fixing. What do you make of all this?
I think one of the worst legacies of state capture and the ANC's governance is the hollowing out of police services above all. For exactly the reason that you cannot outsource all aspects of policing to the private sector. It's just isn't that's the only thing. If they guarantee or not guarantee, but undertake nothing else, it's got to be the protection of citizenry. What it talks about is very poor management, terrible police ministers, impunity on the part of the ANC hierarchy that has seen the state as a source of corruption and benefit. And what this tells us is that the private security sector is a visceral response to being made to feel unsafe. That's what it is. It can't be more than that. But what it also does suggest, as actually the theme of this discussion today is about, is that if the ANC wants to actually save itself by doing better for the country, it's going to be a lot more about negotiating genuine partnerships with the private sector. I mean, I see, for example, that advocates Matthew Chaskelson and Paul Pretorius, evidence leaders at Zondo, have been pulled into prosecutions for the NPA. Now, you know, that is but a start, and we've been talking about that sort of thing for years. But the ANC as a government, and perhaps the advantage now being that it's not the majority in government, is that it actually has to compromise in order for things to work. And whatever one may say about the private sector, there's one thing everyone desperately needs is for things to work. And part of what business needs, as we all need individually, is less crime, better managed, better solved. And to me, that's, you know, it's just not going to happen if the government is determined to forge ahead when, in fact, it's just sort of forging behind up till now. So it is about pulling together, but you know, some genuine compromises will have to be made.
Any final thoughts, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think just to underscore what Cyrus has been saying, we're not going to get ahead as a society. Everybody these days appears to be on the same page, talking about the need for growth, for jobs, and so on. So this is a really positive thing, but there's not going to be any growth unless there is great security, unless all these quite frightening manifestations of criminal activity, such as the various mafias that have emerged, and there are lots of them, lots of different kinds of organizations that have realized there's a scope for criminal activity. Unless all of that is tackled, and it's tackled in a constructive, meaningful way that visibly that people feel palpably safer, that there's a visible improvement, unless that happens, we're not going to get the growth and the stability and the jobs that a better future for everybody depends on. So very important.
All right, let's go on to our last two stories. We'll just sort of bundle them together quickly. One is that a number of people in business, and indeed to some degree our old boss Franz Kunia, have told government that if the government of national unity fails, South Africa as a whole is going to be in a lot of trouble, that a growing economy is vital to South Africa's future as a stable, peaceful, prosperous, democratic state. Our former boss, Franz Kronje, said that politics is limited by economics in the short term. In the long term, economics is limited by politics. We could have stability and growth for a generation if the government of national unity works. So while keeping that in mind, let us have a quick look at what's going on in the MK party. Last week we talked about the MK party firing about a third of its MPs for unclear reasons. I'm actually not sure on the latest of that, knowing MK, they could have been rehired since then. But there has apparently been some internal squabbling within MK that was reported in the papers over the weekend. A number of interim regional leaders in MK apparently wrote a letter to Jacob Zuma complaining about the lack of structure inside the party. The letter in part reads, quote, "The absence of a structured political framework has left the regions unsupported and lacking guidance in making crucial political decisions. The vacuum has significantly hindered our ability to deal with issues faced by the regions that require a provincial interim committee intervention." The spokesperson for the MK party said that the party can only appoint regional structures with the vetting of party members from national to provincial and regional structures, and that they were just dealing with a number of rogue members here. Somewhat confusingly, he said, "I'm not aware of any meeting that took place yesterday, Saturday," which is apparently when these regional leaders met with Zuma. "It could have taken place probably, but I'm not 100% sure. We're not going to be dictated to on setting up structures. We've been dealing with rogue members here. Certain people want structures set up so they can occupy positions. People need to calm down. We're going to set up structures. There is no doubt about that." Ideally, you set up structures before an election, but you know, I get that MK said they were going to focus on the election and not do that. Sara, what do you make of these two stories?
Well, this, the first story supports everything we've said in the rest of the program, and that is if the IFP and the ANC said the business must come to the party, and the answer is yes, they must, and yes, they will, but it's reciprocal. With regard to MK, let's say they've been a very good lesson in what happens when you support a very charismatic, crooked, venal human being who has always had the benefit of other people running the organization that he's been able to operate in. Now that he's got to administer the boring stuff of the organization they have to operate in, it's not looking too good. It's much more complex and much more banal and much more uninteresting than shooting your mouth off. And, you know, if that's the way we have to learn, that's the way we have to learn. But, you know, if you come, perhaps the lesson in this is that whatever the faults are with the other big parties, they've at least done the hard yards. You can't do it the other way around.
That's exactly right. Michael, any thoughts before we close up?
Just a final thing, and again, just to reinforce something that Sara said, talking about the reciprocal, the vital reciprocity between you know the GNU and society and business and so on. I think what we can say is that business will definitely come. Business will join the party and invest and do all the right things as long as the GNU gives it reason to do so. I don't think business is going to have to be, you know, reluctantly dragged, kicking and screaming into a successful society where there are opportunities to succeed. It will come the minute it sees those. And I think he's very keen we often find they're sometimes a little too optimistic, but our experience of South African business is it's, you know, it's absolutely willing to party. And the GNU should be aware of that. That reciprocity, I think, is a very key thing, Sara.
Exactly. All right. That is all the time we have for today. We will, of course, be back tomorrow with the Daily Print Wrap in the afternoon. So check us out then. And I hope you all have a wonderful day. We'll see you tomorrow. Cheers, everyone.